the way in which it was expressed in the Greek mind. And for the Greeks, it was a symbol. But the Greeks got it from the Egyptians. And for the Egyptians, it was not a symbol in the mind. It was a ritual experience of the horizon. And if you go into Egyptian theology, we call it now, but the Egyptian understanding of reality is all related to the horizon, what is above it and what is below it. And the experience in ancient Egypt of the horizon is the ritual prototype of the Greek experience of balance as an idea symbolically in the mind. So that Homer, about 1000 BC, is intimately related up with the Egyptian ritual of about 3000 BC. Only whereas the Egyptian ritual expressed it in a dramatic ritual presentation, Homer expresses it in an artistic symbolic expression, the Odyssey in this case. This is from Book 4 in the Richmond Lattimore translation. As you hear this, one thing to keep in mind, which you may not recognize, or you may not be on your toes, I have to remember sometimes that I lived this stuff for, I don't know, since I was a little tiny boy, so it's just like everyday intelligence to me. The name in here, Pharos, Pharos was an island off the Egyptian coast. And Pharos was the place where the city of Alexandria was founded. Not only the island, but the place on shore right off from the island. And on Pharos was where they built the great lighthouse. The lighthouse of Alexandria in Hellenistic times was 40 some stories high. It was as tall as a skyscraper. And the person who built that was Alexander the Great. He set it out because he carried Homer with him all the time. Carried Homer in a jeweled case, and every night before he went to sleep, they read Homer out loud. It was supposed to be read out loud, chanted out loud, like a charm song, but like a very sophisticated charm song. It brought out the archetypal energies in full. And that was the power, and that is the power of poetry on the level of Homer. That when you really live in that cultural milieu and someone really chants those archetypal charm songs, all of the images come out whole. And one experiences the reality, the veracity of life. It's not like some psychologists and some university professors think that old people used to believe in myth. Those people were much more sophisticated than we are in terms of the wholeness of life. They got us here. That's how good they were. So Pharos is the place where Alexandria was founded, and it first is mentioned here in the Odyssey of Homer. This is the very first place, and it becomes an archetypal place for the Greeks in their symbolic mind because of what Homer writes here. Odysseus' son is hoping that his father will come back, and someone named King Menelaus. Have you ever heard of Menelaus? His wife was famous. Her name was Helen. And she's the one that started the Trojan War. She had red hair and greenish eyes, and Menelaus had red hair and green eyes and didn't want somebody with blonde hair and brown eyes to have her. It's about like that. men are like that. So Menelaus tells the son, Telemachus, the son of Odysseus, I will not turn away from the tale and speak idly, nor will I deceive you, but of what the ever-truthful old man of the sea told me, I will tell all without concealment and hold back nothing. The gods held me still in Egypt when I was eager to come back here, for I had not rendered complete hecatombs to them, sacrifices. The gods have always desired that their orders should be listened to. There is an island there, and the heavy wash of the open sea in front of Egypt, and they call it Pharos. As far out as the distance a hollow ship can make in a whole day's sailing, when a sharp and following wind is blowing it onward. And there is a harbor there with good anchorage, whence they put forth their balanced ships to sea. After they have drawn dark water, there the gods held me 20 days, nor did the sea winds ever appear and blow across the salt water, such winds as act to send ships sailing over the sea's wide ridges. And now the food would all have been gone, and the men's strength with it, if one of the gods had not been sorry for me and shown mercy. Eidothea, daughter of mighty Proteus, the old man of the sea. For it was her heart that I moved mostly when she met me wandering by myself without my companions. And then he has to sacrifice to Proteus, to the old man of the sea, who has his place right there in Egypt, right there on Pharos, on the island. And later on, in the Odyssey, all the way to book 13, when Odysseus finally makes it home to Ithaca, and he's asleep when he's put ashore, and he's put ashore by a people who give him a lot of presents and so forth, and they put him ashore, and here's how Homer writes it. There is a harbor of the old man of the sea, Phorkys, in the countryside of Ithaca. Notice, the old man of the sea has a different name, but it's still the old man of the sea. The same reality, different mythical name. In Egypt, he's called Proteus, from which we get the term Protean. The psyche is Protean. And one of the qualities of the old man of the sea is that he knows everything. The psyche knows everything. Everything there is to know about everything. And the only way to get the psyche to tell the truth is to hold on to the old man of the sea. And he will tell you the truth, except for a little perilous episode. He keeps changing shape, and if any shape he changes to terrifies you and you let go of him, then that shape will kill you. So you have to keep holding him until he goes through all his permutations and there is no shape that scares you. Then he will become himself, and then you can ask anything about anything, and he will tell you the truth. He has a place in Egypt. He has a place also in Ithaca, Odysseus's own kingdom. Homer writes, and this is the north part of Ithaca. If you sailed from this part of Ithaca, you would go up towards Corfu. There are two precipitous promontories opposed, which jut out to close in the harbor and shelter it from the big waves made by the winds blowing so hard on the outside. Inside, the well-benched vessels can lie without being tied up once they have found their anchorage. Notice how calm it is. You don't even have to tie the ships up. But outside, the storms blow freely. At the head of the harbor, There is an olive tree with spreading branches, and nearby is a cave that is shaded and pleasant, and sacred to the nymphs, who are called the nymphs of the wellspring. The Greek term for them was naiads. There are mixing bowls and handled jars inside, all of stone, and there the bees deposit their honey. And it goes on, and this whole image of Homer's Cave of the Nymphs was the great myth of the spiritual nature of the psyche for Neoplatonism. One of Plotinus's students, his biographer, Porphyry, did a little exposition on the Cave of the Nymphs. William Blake did a sacred engraving of the Cave of the Nymphs. And all of this comes from Homer, from this this place. Odysseus is returned home exactly to this place, and when he's returned to this place exactly, the white buffalo robe woman comes to him. Only in Homeric Greece, she was called Athena. You're beginning to see that white buffalo cow woman doesn't have anything to do with romantic love. I don't mean to denigrate Johnson, he does as good as he can, but I wish to say is much more profound. He wakes up and he starts carrying his treasures into the Cave of the Nymphs, and just as soon as he thinks he's got all of his treasures home and he's made it, she's there. He doesn't know, because his mind is full of his homecoming and his treasures. He just sees there's somebody there. So they have this conversation, and I'll cut in at this level. So she spoke, and resourceful great Odysseus was happy, rejoicing in the land of his fathers, when Pallas Athena, daughter of Zeus of the Aegis, on Athena's breastplate. She's an armed woman. Wisdom is an armed woman. She is woman, but she has a spear and can use it. It's like that. On her breastplate, not breasts plate, but on the armor, the breastplate armor, is the image of an owl, which is sacred to Athena. And I told you last week, you can go out to the Getty Museum, and there's a real 5th century statue of Athena there. And you'll see her with the helmet raised up. And her real face is a woman's face, but her mask face is a warrior. And if she pulls the mask down, all you see is the warrior. And she carries a spear, and she carries a shield. But it isn't the spear that is the dangerous part of Athena. The spear goes with the mask, and it's the dangerous part of the mask. But the dangerous part of Athena is that on the inside of the shield, and you can see it in the Getty sculpture, is a huge serpent, a snake, wound in a figure eight in a Hermetic sign on the inside of the shield, and that's the only way you can hold that shield up. The only protection against wisdom is if you can hold your shield with the Hermetic snake. Without that capacity, spear isn't going to do you any good at all. So he answered her again and addressed her in winged words, but he did not tell her the truth, but checked that word from the outset, forever using to every advantage the mind that was in him. And so he has been telling her fibs about himself. She says, who are you, essentially? And he thinks that, you know, she's out, who knows who she is. And so he tells her fibs. And finally, he keeps telling these different stories, and he says, well, I heard the name of Ithaca when I was in wide Crete, far away across the sea. And Now I myself have come here with these goods that you see, but leaving as much again to my children. And so he says that he's a merchant from Crete. And he keeps telling all these stories. He is like an old man of the sea also. He's held the old man of the sea. He's forced him to tell him what he needs to know to make it back home. And so Athena now is experiencing him in this mode. Or to put it the way in which it really happens, he is experiencing this mode in response to Athena, her real person. So he keeps on spinning out this tale, and when he's finished, when he said this tale, this is how Homer writes it, it's beautiful. So he spoke. The gray-eyed goddess Athena smiled on him and stroked him with her hand and took on the shape of a woman, both beautiful and tall and well-versed in glorious handiworks, and spoke aloud to him and addressed him in winged words, saying, "It would be a sharp one and a stealthy one who would ever get past you in any conniving. Even if it were a god against you, you wretch, so devious, never weary of tricks, then you would not, even in your own country, give over your ways of deceiving and your thievish tales. They are near to you in your very nature." And then finally he recognizes that he's talking to the great goddess. He's talking to he's talking to that which in like a psychological works is called the anima, but you can see that that's a name. This presents the ceremonial experience of how that is come to. It's come to in that way. Only in that way. And in case you are not picking up on this fully, Hermes was a thief. Hermes was a thief. Yeah. Norman O. Brown, years ago, 40 years ago, wrote a beautiful monograph on Hermes the thief, which brings out that aspect. When Hermes was little, the first thing he did was steal the cattle of Apollo. And when Apollo caught him, he said, "Well, don't feel too bad. I'll give you a gift for having caught me." And Hermes made him a lute. Orpheus's lyre is 7-string, but Apollo's is 9-string. And he got the lute from Hermes. So the thievishness is not so much a thievishness of taking somebody else's property. The Hermetic thievishness is a whole a mythic presentation of this ritual of taking anything belongs to the undifferentiated universe. And it's profane or sacred, depending on what you do with it, with your purpose. This is not an ambivalent valuation, believe me. It's not that the end justifies the means. That's misthinking this. But it's that if one knows the purposefulness, then that theft is not a theft as a crime, but is a restorative ritual. It's very interesting that this should be. Now let's come over to Black Elk for just a second. The keeping of the soul. The keeping of the soul. I think I'll have you read this on your own. And I think the keeping of the soul and the releasing of the soul probably... All of chapter 2. If you will, in the Sacred Pipe, read all of chapter 2. The keeping of the soul and the releasing of the soul. It's like the making of the sacred. This is the essence of ritual. Ritual always is a way of thieving, as it is. It's stealing from the universe to carve out something which is selected and limited for you or for your people. except that the universe is not going to hold you responsible for stealing. The universe wants you to have this, but wants you to have this only in a sacred way, not in a profane way. If you do not know that you're able to have these things because they're made available for you, you're taking them is a sacred act. It has a purpose. And if you know that, then you may live. If you don't know that, then that is profane, then you are a thief in the derisive sense. It's like, let me use something really prosaic just as a contrast. It's like a mother who has a couple of little boys, and she knows they like cookies, and she lets them see that she's bought some cookies, and she lets them see where she puts it on the shelf. Now those little boys go in there and they steal some cookies for themselves. Are they thieves? Yeah, technically they're thieves. But from the mother's standpoint, they're her sons, and this is a way of letting them get the, I have to use the term, the chutzpah to forage in life. They need that, otherwise they're not going to be able to survive. They need to know that they have a right to go out and get what they need. But to understand, every time they raise the ante of what they take for what they need, to understand, to put it to use. And what is the use? To essentially amplify and integrate and fulfill that life, that person which they are. And so they'll never take anything in a way which would jeopardize that integrity. And there are ways of getting what you need. There are transformational processes that one can go into. And you see, so the beginning of the thieving for a little boy in this kind of a way is the beginning of his development into manhood in that sort of a way. I don't know if this came across, but at least you begin to get some sense in this. Hermes, when he's a little boy, is a thief, and when he's really grown up and is a grandfather, he's thrice great as Hermes. It's like that. And in between, he's a Thoth. Hermes the thief is the boy, and Thoth is the man. And Hermes Trismegistus is the wise grandfather, is the teacher of the civilization. Hermes, the little boy, is trying to be himself, and Thoth is trying to be the man for the family and the nation. And Hermes Trismegistus is concerned with the civilization and the cosmos. It's like an amplification, three giant steps. It's like that. I feel that we're just about filled, but I want to draw your attention to this basic quality. This is the paramount quality in what we've been talking about all day today. And I think that you can maybe appreciate it if I put it in this perspective. This is a couple of quotations from a book published by the University of California Press, Masks, Transformation, and Paradox, published just a couple of years ago, published in 1986. I'll leave the cover out here so some of you can see the cover. And I think it's in paperbound now. The Greek word prosopon, that's the emphasis, prosopon, P-R-O-S-O-P-O-N, prosopon. The emphasis in classical Greek is always on the second syllable. So you count the vowels, and the second vowel is where the emphasis is, prosopon. The Greek word prosopon was, as the Latin persona, used to designate a mask. To suggest, however, that prosopon and mask are entirely equitable or equatable would be inaccurate. Prosopon is a much more complex term. Prosopon properly referred to a manifestation, a figure. Such a primary meaning implies that masks were conceived of as belonging to a much broader class of phenomenon than the mere object is usually taken to mean. This is a mask, but to only see that this is the mask is a delimited perspective. It's a consciousness which is so narrow and fragile and brittle that it can be manipulated by even a strong feeling, much less the deception of the mind, much less the strong undertows of the subconscious. It's not only that this is a mask, but that the mask embodies in itself the entire ritual comportment expressed in a dramatic thread. So it expresses the whole of ritual comportment, but specifically a dramatic thread which runs through that ritual comportment. So that in having the mask, one has a key to the dramatization. And what to do with the mask is to put it into play to find out what it dramatically exemplifies. The mask exemplifies the drama. And so it becomes extremely important. This particular Chinese mask has terror, and it has humor. So it's either on the basis of your perception, and both of them together. So if the mask is not a mask to conceal, in the sense then that one wants to get rid of the mask and find out what's real underneath it, it's not like that at all. In fact, in really powerful dreams, what happens if you manage to take the mask off the figure is the figure has no face. What's important is that the mask expresses in a primordial beginning way what the face will be. And so one doesn't try to take the mask off, but to see the mask and what it expresses. And then when one tells oneself the story of the mask, that's the myth. That's the mythic horizon. That's the mythic level. Then one has a language that you can work with, which is focused on the mask, which is founded on, remember what we talked about before the break, the mask is founded on a reality in nature, not the other way around. Not the other way at all. And on a ritual level, there's a basic polarity, a basic moiety, which is always operative. The classic expression of this comes in the emblems of the dramatic world. The dramatic world as a whole, as an ensemble, the world of theater, is expressed by the mask of tragedy and comedy. That's the moiety on that ritual level of dramatization, you see. I don't know if I'm stepping too far out, if this is coming through or what, but the important thing here, just as our author here says, because it's only when one understands that the mask is important, it's not just the object which is hiding something, but it is the focus of an expression which is delivering of value, delivering a dramatization. So one has to learn about that. Instead of taking it off, one focuses on it and plays it out. This way is the way of therapy. This is what a therapy is. Therapeia is like that. And because on its primordiality, that ritual structure has this polarity, it has the capability dynamically of transformation, moving from one to the other. Transformation. It can move from one aspect of the form to the other. And the importance is not to change the form from this horrible to this humorous, but to understand that it moves. It moves, in fact, back and forth. It's transformable. And to understand that, then one has a leg up on the whole situation. Once that's understood, once that's appreciated, then one knows, for instance, that the psyche is malleable. It doesn't have to be in any particular way. You don't have to be in any particular way. You don't have to be any particular role. You're not condemned to be just that, whatever that is. And that's the first insight that usually bleeds that kind of compulsive energy away from the neurotic difficulties which come from a false identity. One doesn't have to be that identity at all, or any identity necessarily. One can be the whole range of whatever you could conceive of. You are free for that. And that freedom belongs to you. Not as a possession, but as a primordial reality of your very being. So you can see that the mask is extremely important. Let me shift over here to the second quote that I want to give you. Interpreting transformations. What then is the connection between the classical theatrical convention of wearing masks and the commonly observed masking practices of so-called archaic societies? Yeah, we're not reading this book and we're not following, but maybe you don't know. Classical theater always had masks. You never were out on the stage in your everyday face. You always had a mask. And the reason for this is that that mask gives veracity to the dramatic moment. If you wore your everyday face, that would profane the drama. Notice the exchangeable quality of profaneness. If you wore a mask in everyday life, that would be wrong. If you wore your everyday face in a dramatic production, that would be wrong. It's profane when it's out of context. But you who have an everyday face can also wear a mask in a dramatic production. But if you make the mistake of trying to transpose that ritual comportment to another level, a higher level, to the person, for instance, then you have what we call a fixation, right? Then you're really fixed, as they used to say in the South. Fixed as diced in front. So what is the connection between the classical theatrical convention of wearing masks and the commonly observed masking practices of so-called archaic societies? To compare the mimetic art of acting as it occurred in ancient times with the role of masks in other cultures, we must come to terms with the cross-cultural differences in what it is to personify and what personification implies categorically. And we're gonna stop there with the understanding that masks in some way personify. They are not the person, but they personify. And maybe the easiest rule of thumb is to consider that the mask is like a sketch for the portrait. A mask is like a sketch for the portrait, which the person is. It takes a while to learn how to sketch. And when one learns how to sketch, the way in which you see is modified. If you've never tried this, you can just try it for yourself. Take an object and try and sketch it for about 10 minutes every day for the 7 days until next week. And you can see that after a while, what you do when you see, when you've learned to sketch, is that you're aware that the eye composes. You're aware that what you're doing is not just photographically, mechanically recording what is there. You're composing. The sketch is a record of the composing activity, not an imitation of the object. So that the sketch expresses the activity and not the object is a very, very interesting kind of realization. And in just this way, acting, drama, ritual are the ways in which human beings began to hone themselves into seeing the real. It worked. We got here out of those roots. And as long as we recall that, as long as we know that, we will never be lost, and we will be free to go wherever we wish to go. If we don't know that, the very sacred heritage of mankind will work as a profane nightmare against us. Well, we'll see you next week. Thank you. I guess my wife opened up her studio down below. If you're interested to see her paintings and her studio, why?